And you gonna murder this one and murder that one. Talking all that bullshit. I'ma put it to you like this, yo.
This is for the nerds. This is for the brainiacs. This is what we deserve. Go ahead and play it back. You ain't gonna touch me. You not gonna do nothing. You are not above me. I bet you wish you was me. I know it, I know.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Only Friends Podcast. We have a special one for you today, ladies and gentlemen. We've done it. We've cracked the code. We've managed to listen to endless hours of Tom Dwan. We ran it through the AI and we said, tell us what the fuck this guy is saying. And I think we have answers. We're going to get to that in a little bit. We're going to have a strat chat today with the one and only Matt Hunt. Thank you for joining us. As always,
hello.
On Wednesdays.
Happy to be here, as always.
Teaching us all about rugby and its popularity in...
teaching you off camera about rugby.
Different portions of, of the UK.
We're not going to talk about rugby on this podcast. I'm not
Did you guys
expert.
Know that New Zealand is not in Europe?
Wait, I just found that out, thanks to you.
Hey.
Yeah.
You don't get to get upset at me when you jumped in midway through. I specifically said, what parts of Europe play rugby? Because I know that it's popular in Australia. I think of it as Australian rules football. Is that different, by the way?
It's very different. Aussie rules and rugby are completely different sports.
How do they differ?
What is different?
What is different?
That's a long conversation, but,
We got time.
They're it's all, how can I put it? Probably the simplest thing is in rugby, you can only pass the ball backwards using your hands. So rugby is a lot of run, pass backwards, etc. Aussie rules, I don't think that's the case. And Aussie rules, there's a lot less running with the ball because you have to like bounce it in some weird way if you want to run for more than
that's
like 10
right.
steps.
That's why I always thought of Aussie rules. So on the playground when we were kids, if you would catch a pass on a bounce, we'd go Australian rules.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what Aussie rules. Like there's a whole thing about bouncing the ball.
If you played football, if you caught it off a bounce, it counted.
It didn't actually count, but you would try to lobby for it by claiming Aussie rules.
Right.
You
know? But I, being English, I feel like I'm some Australian out there is getting very mad about the fact that I'm even daring to talk about Aussie rules right now. So I'm going to back out of the conversation.
He's abstaining.
The England-Australia rivalry is very real.
Is tetherball a thing on the East Coast?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a volleyball attached to a rope.
First time
pole.
I ever got the wind really knocked out of me, I was playing tetherball. It sucked.
And Americans just love creating sports that no one else plays, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of our thing.
Pickleball, tetherball. There's probably a bunch of other sports with ball on the end that no
Football?
One's ever heard of. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, that's the obvious one.
It's the most popular sport in the world and no one else plays it.
Yes, exactly.
That's got to be a one of one.
Yes.
I don't know if that exists anywhere else. I was going to ask you... Oh, this is the last rugby question I have.
Okay.
Do you have to touch the goal line? Is that a thing or is that just like...
Scoring a try is you have to put the ball down beyond the goal line.
Okay.
So it's like a touchdown, except instead of just carrying the ball into the end zone, you have to actually put it down.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it sometimes it's like you're like stretching and you just managed to get it down. Sometimes it's like very easy, but it has to touch the ground.
Okay. So we are the land of making up stupid games. Mm-hmm. And you are the land of making up stupid rules.
Yes.
Okay.
Apparently. England is also the land of creating a sport, bringing it to the world, and then absolutely sucking at it for like 100 years. That's what we specialize in.
You hate to see that.
Always have done.
Yeah, you definitely hate to see that.
More like cricket.
Well, we've been good at cricket a couple times, but we're kind of, we're not great right now.
Is it your sport initially?
Cricket?
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
I know it is basically an Indian sport, but...
It's the second most popular sport in the world.
Exactly. India is obviously the country that plays it the most because they have the most people, but England is 100% the home of cricket for sure.
Okay. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We've gotten to the root of all of this. Much like we're going to get to the root of what the hell is going on with Tom Dwan and his debts. So
What the hell is going on?
I
don't think anyone knows.
I did.
Feldman knows.
Feldman does not know. That's abundantly clear based off of his tweet. I did the painful labor that I would never ask you to do. So I'm going to fill you in right here, right now.
Our hero.
I mean, if you asked us to do it, we would probably say no. So it's probably good that you didn't.
Quite reasonable. Quite reasonable. But, you know, we got to talk about it. It's kind of our thing.
Mm-hmm. Not a news source.
I listened to... So we spoke about this, I think, 2 days ago on Monday. And unbeknownst to me, there was another interview between Chad Holloway and Durr that had just come out a few hours prior to us going live.
A two-parter.
Correct. So the first one was only 8 minutes, which I had seen, and literally nothing was said. But unbeknownst to me, a second interview had been released that was like 45 minutes, 50 minutes long. And, you know, we basically went on air, spoke about it as though the 8 minute one was the only one. Well, let me tell you.
But wait, there's more.
Wait, there's more. So Chad did follow up. You know, again, like we spoke about this a little bit on Monday, but like I don't think it's any one person's job within this space, especially the way that we're kind of set up as talking heads, let's say it. I don't think that it's any one person's job to be like Walter Cronkite and really hit him with the hard questions and, you know, try to drag the, I want the truth, God damn it. Like, you know, it's not going to happen.
What movie is that you're quoting right
you
there?
Can't I think handle the truth.
I think I
it's, yeah, it's yeah. A Few Good Men. Is it?
I think
is, that, is that the movie?
I think I smushed A Few Good Men together with. I feel like you. What did I say? I want the truth.
You said I want the truth. God damn it! Yeah. And I was that's
Tom Cruise. At one point, does say I want the truth.
Yeah. You're right.
That's true.
You're right.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. It was A Few Good Men. Anyway. Chad followed up and he asked all of the questions that I think we wanted asked. Mostly there may have been a few that were left off, but the one that stuck out to me that just never got cleared up was the $225K or whatever that Peter is claiming Tom owes him. And it just seems to be very triggering. Every time that it's brought up, Tom just gets tilted. And he like vocally says like, I'm tilted. I don't want to talk about this. It's like, all right, man, like we're really trying hard to follow along here, but I think you guys should listen to a small portion of this interview at some point in time.
No.
Because it's insane how somebody can talk for so long without saying anything. I mean, look, I do it 5 days a week. I know what a fucking talent it is, but I mean, he's asking like direct yes and no questions, and Durr just like dives off into a rabbit hole. Of, well, you know, in 2017, when Peter and I were walking hand in hand on the beach of Normandy, we discussed what would happen if someone owed another one $225K. And I don't like the cut of his jib right now. It's like, holy shit, man. Can we just get to the bottom of this? So I took nothing away from this interview. I learned nothing.
So new. You want us to listen?
Yes, I want you to listen. I was equally as confused.
We can share your pain.
I basically only brought this first interview up because A, it stole 50 minutes of my life, and I'm very upset about that. But B, I want to let like Chad off the hook because it wasn't due to a lack of asking the right questions or follow-ups. It was just, you know, Durr is an escape artist. I mean, he was just ducking and weaving and, you know, shirking every single direct question that Chad could throw at him. Everything got, you know, shifted into a sidebar of some sort. It was really hard to keep him on track. Also, like, I think Durr had, like, in both interviews, the one that he did with Vertucci, too, I think he has, like, his mind works in a way where it, like, maps ahead. And, you know, they would ask a question and try to provide context to said question. Like, so Peter says that you owe him, and Durr would, like, cut him off and be like, let me tell you. And then you can provide the context after I tell you what happened. And he did this both with Chad and with Nick. And it's like, well, for the listener, that's not the way it works. If you give me a bunch of details where I have no context and then you fill in the context at the end, there isn't going to be like some big aha moment. I'm just going to be wildly confused.
Yeah, I think there's this weird thing that smart people do. When a smart person gets into trouble for something that they've done, that they've fucked up, like, I think they get this weird idea that if they can just find the right combination of words,
yeah,
everyone will just believe them and it'll all go away.
Or at least see it from their perspective. Like
yeah.
Because I think Tom, I mean, you know, without getting into the details just yet, but like, I think Tom genuinely sees the situation the way that it went down or the way that like he's explaining how it went down. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely think he doesn't think that he's done anything wrong. I think that he believes that he's often taken advantage of, which for what it's worth, like the handful of details that he has kind of like slowly given us, even though, you know, maybe he makes us do a little bit of work to dig them out. I do think that, like, you know, he's a lazy bookkeeper. He doesn't keep good accounting, and he's very free with money. So it seems as though there's a lot of room for people to take advantage to varying degrees, right? So he's kind of opened himself up to being taken advantage of. And I think what happens is he just mostly deals with friends who he trusts so that they won't take advantage of him. So I think this whole situation with Peter, who we know was very close to him at one point in time, I think that it's like really struck a nerve with him, where it's like, fuck, man, I'm getting like raked over the coals by a good buddy of mine in a situation that could have been rectified, not publicly, in what I deem to be a fair and reasonable solution. So fast forwarding a bit, they did ultimately decide to take this to arbitration. Peter tweeted yesterday after the Vertucci interview dropped, you know, great news, guys. Tom's agreed to go to arbitration. Now we can work backwards to the details of how they got there. And I have to tell you, man, the Vertucci pod, I've watched a handful of his stuff, and rarely do I think that he's the most direct person on the show, but it was clear that he was the only one saying words strung together that actually formulated a full thought. And that's like pretty frustrating whenever your guest is doing 80% of the talking and has all of the details that you're curious to get to the bottom of. But like, it was kind of wild to watch it go back and forth, because Tom would give this very long answer, and then Nick and Veronica would interpret the answer totally differently.
Wow.
And neither one of them, I don't think, were like fully interpreting it the way Tom had intended it. So he would then get frustrated and then give you another long answer, trying to get them to see what he, you know what I mean? Long and short of it is, this $225,000 number, maybe it's 265, I can't recall, is a thing. Okay. So this actually happened. Peter's accounting, or recounting of what occurred is facts. Nobody's denying that. Tom hasn't denied it. Peter keeps doubling and tripling down on it. So it seems as though this is the one point that we can jump off of that has happened. There was $265,000 or $225,000 put up for the Aussie Millions that Tom had some responsibility to. Now, how much is where the debate will come into play later. But what ultimately it appears to have happened, so Tom leaked some more information in the Vertucci pod that maybe was unintentional, but kind of got out there. In the Chad Holloway podcast or interview, he mentioned that he was partners with somebody in backing Peter. In the Vertucci podcast, he mentions that he had to settle up with Ike based off of this figure. Now, I think a lot of people heard that and believed Ike to be the silent partner in backing Peter that Tom previously referred to. But later on in the interview, he makes it abundantly clear that that's not the case, and that the person that who he was splitting the action with to back Peter was a mutual friend of theirs that had no relation to Ike whatsoever, but he didn't want to say publicly who that person was. So what I gather from that is Ike floated Peter some of the money of this $225K. Ike floated some of it on behalf of Tom, with Peter and Tom basically vouching that Ike would get paid back. And it appears as though that's happened. It sounds like Tom gave Ike $100K in Jeju, and Tom has since sent Peter about $50K over the course of the last couple of months. I think he recently sent him 30 and he sent him 20 like 6 months ago based off of a tweet that Peter put out. So that's a total of 150K. There's now a 96K dispute. So I guess the overall total was somewhere in the neighborhood of like 144 then. So what's left now is this $96,000 balance, which Peter is claiming he fronted for these buy-ins. Now, Matt, you and Landon, you're both backed. This isn't an uncommon practice for somebody who's backed, right? Like, you guys put up your own money, and at some point down the line, the backer pays you back, right? It's just a clear loan. And to be clear, this has nothing to do with makeup, right? Like, there's no scenario where you put up 100K worth of buy-ins and get dropped and somehow aren't owed that 100K.
Right.
Right? That's abundantly clear, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's really no scenario where you put up that 100K and your backer pauses your backing deal and you're not owed that money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The only scenario where your backer would have a claim that he doesn't owe you that money is if you're deep in makeup and you just quit, right? Mm-hmm. Because then you're going to be on the hook for some amount of that makeup to pay it back, right?
If you just decide to quit?
Yeah. If you just exit the deal.
I always thought it was like you owe just the full amount of it.
I think over the years, a lot of that's changed.
Unless like you stone quit poker for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So generally it's like, it starts with you owe the full amount, but I think that people recognize that makeup amount isn't worth all of that. Right. So usually it gets diluted in some capacity, because if somebody's going to buy your makeup, they're going to buy it for cents on a dollar. Right. So it's kind of like you buying that makeup. So it doesn't make much sense that the open market would get it for 30 cents on the dollar, but you're paying 100%. Right. So I think a lot of times what will happen is backers will offer to accept like a 30% buyout, and now you're free, and you basically just purchased your own makeup in that regard. And I think that's becoming more common practice. Makes sense for all parties. But anyway, point being is that's the only scenario through which this debt could potentially be canceled out. And the reason I frame it that way is because Tom seems to be leaning pretty heavily on that argument. He continues for 90 plus minutes to bring up that Peter's 1.6 million in makeup. Peter's 1.6 million in makeup. I was just going to let him off on the makeup and not care about it. But since he's making such a fuss over this debt, I think I need to hold his feet to the fire to where he owes me something for the makeup. Now, my understanding is, unless Peter was not dropped and Tom is actively trying to put him in things and Peter's saying no, that can't be the case, right? It sounds as though publicly Peter hasn't played for Tom since this time frame in the Aussie Millions. And I don't know if that was a mutual decision, if Tom actively dropped him or if Tom just like stopped sending him money, but you know, if it falls on the hands of the backer to stop funding the horse, then the horse obviously is not on the hook for the makeup. Tom could sell his makeup if he so chooses in order to recoup some of this cash and then pay Peter back. But I don't think that it ultimately falls on Peter. So basically what we learned from this interview, just to hash out top to bottom all the details, is that it appears the figure that is owed to Peter was partially him fronting buy-ins that Tom was responsible for, partially Ike fronting buy-ins that Tom was responsible for, and those numbers being need to be made whole. There were a lot of other details that weren't really important. Like, prior to Aussie Millions, Peter had squared up and made like a quarter million or something along those lines. Has nothing to do with anything. Then the 1.6 million in makeup seems to have nothing to do with anything. And you know, don't get me wrong, I could easily be getting this incorrect, because what's also clear is the way that Peter tweets and the way Tom speaks, there's so many more details that they're omitting, right? Like, it's just abundantly clear when Tom is going on this like 10 minute long speech, you can actually hear him editing out things in his mind, like in his speech. Like, I don't want to talk about him. I don't want to talk about what happened at that time. I don't want to talk about this detail or that detail. It's like, this was just never meant to be hashed out in public. And it seems as though Tom is upset that it got dragged there, and Peter's upset that it's taken 4 years or 3 years, whatever, to get his money back, when it seems as though he's probably not in a super great financial situation, right? And that's going to put a lot of stress on him. So the final takeaway is the arbiters are going to figure it out. It sounds as though one side or the other is going to get made whole. All of this is much ado about nothing. I don't think Tom, personally, I don't think Tom is like a bad guy. I don't think it was malicious. I could see a world where he's a slow payer. I could see a world where he's very irresponsible with accounting and sloppy with money and how he doles it out. But I don't think any of it's necessarily malicious. Mm-hmm. And then to clarify, like, and again, I'm just going on Tom's side here because we haven't heard from Horolibus. But to clarify that debt, he basically said what's happening is Horolibus is holding Tom accountable for what appears to be a soft vouch for a third party mutual friend between the three of them that never paid Bob. So Tom's kind of like getting put on the hook in a spot where I guess he kind of vouched for somebody's character and that guy rugged for all of Bob for $350K. So like, I don't know what the resolution of this will all be. I truly don't care. The fact that this ended up being public was probably very messy and unnecessary, but
what's the most you've ever vouched for someone? Like
a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
That doesn't make you nervous.
Yeah. Well, it was for Jay and like, I wasn't nervous, but, I've said no to people that I trust implicitly would never fuck me over because it was too much of my net worth. It was just like, you know, can you vouch for like $500,000 for me on this crypto trade? And it's like, I trust you a lot. Like 99% positive you wouldn't fuck me here. But also, like, that means I'm losing $5,000 by vouching for you on average. And they were like, oh, you know, I'll return the favor in the future. And it's like, I'll never need it. Yeah. I just won't need it. I don't operate in those streets. I haven't needed a hard vouch in years outside of like the airball challenge, in which case I just escrowed the money if I needed to anyway. Like
$500,000?
Yeah, it was a lot.
Would you if you're 99% sure if they paid you $10,000 to do it?
Yeah.
Then what?
Yeah, I would do it for $10,000. Maybe not though, because then my like confidence goes down.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, my confidence goes way down. It's like, oh, pay $10,000 to roll me for $500,000? That seems smart. Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not. I've just seen this stuff go south way, way, way too often. Like the hard vouch system is incredibly efficient in a money market like poker, where everything is just dealt with in liquidity.
Isn't that how Brad Booth got into that whole mess?
That's a good question.
I think it was a lot of vouching stuff.
I could see that being the case.
Yeah.
The problem with the hard vouch system is everybody's good for it until they're not. And the things that can trigger them not being good for it are often unpredictable, right? Like, there's a story of somebody who had like 4 million in hard vouches out, or had like 4 million worth of hard vouches for him. And he was trading at like 100x leverage, shorting Bitcoin during a bull run, and just like went fucking dust and didn't have it, obviously, because he had borrowed that 4 million and then traded on 100x leverage, you know? So it's like, you don't know the thing that's going to trigger it, right? Like if basically that guy's name would still be fucking gold if he were on the other side of it, if he were longing Bitcoin during the bull market, right? He would have just made a bunch of money and everyone would be like, oh my God, like how great. Like we gave this guy 4 million in hard vouchers and he immediately paid. It was no big deal. Like what a smooth trade. You know, but it's like, oh no, like he lost his mind for 36 hours, dusted it all off, and now everybody's totally fucked. It's not ideal, you know. But in this industry, the problem is that you're only as good as your word. So if you're willing to vouch for people and someone does rug you, you're pretty on the fucking hook to pay. Like it's tough not to pay, especially if you're smart about how you're vouching. You're not vouching for numbers that you couldn't afford to pay, you know, doing $10,000 here, $20,000 there, $50,000, whatever. Like there are amounts that you'll lose some small portion of the time, but you'll be able to recoup them because you can earn that much. But when it becomes $500,000, $1 million, $2 million,
I would also imagine it's like there's the aspect of trusting someone, but there's also the aspect of like that person can have all the good intentions and be completely trustworthy, but then they can just make a mistake. Like they can literally, like yeah. You say, they can do something that or something can happen to them that's completely outside their control, right? Like, what if someone
dies?
Suddenly, that's a great example.
They just
get hit by a bus tomorrow, and now you're vouching for $500,000 because this guy got hit by a bus. Like, it's more than just 1% of how much, like, maybe I don't trust them, but it's some percentage of, like, what can happen that's outside of anybody's control, you know?
Landon, are you in the vouching streets?
No. Not in the vouching streets. Probably good streets to not be in.
I agree.
There's a lot of streets you're in, but those are not.
Yeah, not the vouching ones.
I mean, borrowing power is very important in this industry.
What are you for?
You're in the vouching streets more than you think. You get lent a lot of money on the finger.
Sneak vouch.
It's not really a sneak vouch. Like, you definitely could run up a tab.
I could, but I'm not going to.
Sure. But
just
because
I can doesn't mean I will.
No, trust me, I understand. It's just inevitable. Like, with all the travel that takes place, with the short notice oftentimes for games popping up, it's very important to have borrowing power. And oftentimes the only way to have borrowing power is to also have lending power. And if you're not super liquid, the easiest way to have lending power is to vouch. If you're willing to vouch for a bunch of people, they'll vouch for you in return, or they'll lend you in return, and that'll go a long way. But it's a very scary endeavor. Like, I think people are too free with it. I think they're too quick to, like, just look somebody in the face and say, like, do I trust this person, yes or no? If answer yes, then I'll vouch, where they should be doing, like, risk calculations and actually running this through kind of like a risk of ruin calculator of, like, okay, well, how much of my net worth
Sims,
or like, how much of my net liquidity is this amount that I'm vouching for, and what percentage likelihood do I think that this person will roll me? Is it worth me risking, like, in that situation, it was like, was it worth me risking 5 to 10K in order to earn a hard vouch in the future? And, like, fuck no, like, not even close, you know? And not because I don't value that future hard vouch, but it's just like, that's just way, way, way too much of a premium to pay for the ability to borrow some amount down the line.
Got to get in the vouching streets.
Yeah.
The vouching Sims.
Got to, especially with crypto, man. It's tough not to. All right, let's get to today's lesson of the day, if you will. We're going to get into a fun strat chat discussion. This was a user submission. Big shout out to Billy from Pittsburgh, my guy.
Of course it's a person from Pittsburgh.
Yeah, well,
those are the only viewer suggestions you actually pay attention
that's
to,
true.
I'm sure. Anyone from Pittsburgh, it's like you instantly get to the top of the queue of suggestions.
Isn't from Pittsburgh.
Billy Pilsoff has been playing with me since 2003. The man deserves to get his requests heard.
Wow, 2003. That's some longevity.
Yeah, we've been grinding.
Yeah.
And he's I've done well. he very much regressed into a nit. And I think that's where this question is coming from. No, no offense, Billy, but, you know, we both know that you're on the tighter side. But he said, yeah, like, you know, playing at Rivers and more people were just, like, overbetting all of a sudden, and he wants to know what the fuck is going on.
All these kids.
I thought let's have a talk about it. Let's discuss what the incentives are behind the overbet, because I do think that it's a concept that's probably largely mimicked and mostly misunderstood.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there was a certain time period when it started to become like the thing that everybody was doing. And I still feel like there's a lot of people out there, particularly the sort of deal player crew or crowd, that tends to follow the trends and do certain things without necessarily knowing why they're happening. I do think there's been a lot of mimicking that's taken place. And I think there's probably a lot of players out there who overbet pretty often without really knowing exactly what the reasons are why it's good. Like, they're not necessarily getting it wrong, but they're kind of using it in spots where they might be missing some spots, but they also might be taking some spots that they shouldn't take and so on, you know?
Yeah, I think in order to discuss anything related with overbetting, we have to introduce a very simple concept, which is polarization.
Mm-hmm.
So for anybody who's familiar with like the toy game, the Ace, King, Queen toy game, or if you're not familiar with it, we'll explain it very quickly now. But it's effectively when you arrive at the river and you have a decision where you're in position and you're always checked to, and your opponent always has a bluff catcher. So bluff catchers in this example are represented by the king. The ace is the nuts, and the queen is a bluff. the question then becomes, you know, how do we treat our range when we have an ace or a king or a queen? And effectively, what happens is we tend to trend towards the poles. Or I guess the game is that we always have the ace or the queen because they have the king, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So we're polarized here, and what we mean by that is that we only have the nuts or air. So it's a very simple concept that you've all understood since the dawn of playing poker of nuts or air. It's just a lot more technical and mathematically qualified or quantified whenever we are actually able to take fractions of our range and use them to represent each of these positions, right? The river's the easiest spot to do it because there's no more equity. There's no more equity to be divvied up, right? We're at a finite point in the game tree.
And it's possible for a hand to have 100% or 0% equity.
Right.
Not really possible on the turn or especially on the flop.
Yeah, correct. So, you know, basically the way this game plays out, it ends up being a pot odds sort of example type of thing of like, well, if there's $1 in the pot and you have $1 to bet, how often should you bet the nuts? How often should you bluff type of thing? So it's actually a toy game used to exemplify value to bluff ratio. But within that is this concept of polarization. And polarization is very critical to the notion of constructing large bet strategies, right? Whether we're talking about whether we start to quantify large as being pot or greater, or we're just talking about geometric sizing. These large strategies are going to be driven by opposite ends of the equity spectrum in our range. So in simplistic terms, what it means is our very, very, very strong hands want to build a large pot. They want to play the biggest pot imaginable. The stronger the hand, the more they want to be all in by the time we arrive at the river. Conversely, our weakest hands have no incentive to play a large pot, but complement our strong hands such that by their sheer existence, our opponents can't just fold when we bet large because the only hands that want to bet large are our best hands.
Right. Right? If we bet, we want to make money with the nuts. We want to make as much money as possible. Therefore, we want to bet as big as possible if our range is exclusively nuts or air. But if we bet as big as possible, if we bet 10x pot all in with the nuts, now the bluff catcher has no incentive to call unless we add a lot of bluffs in there.
Right. Right. So, you know, there's no easy formula for choosing bluffs. And I'm sure you guys that are regulars understand that whenever we do in the muck, you'll see us. It's kind of like looking at a spray chart for baseball. It's like it's kind of all over the place. Like, oh, we're going to bluff from this quadrant and this quadrant. You know, we're just going to pull from all these different areas. But it's easy to understand when a hand has very low equity. A low equity hand is one that is not drawing to anything nutted and doesn't really contain a lot of showdown value. So if you're in a situation where you have five high and the best you can do is improve to a pair, you have a very, very low equity hand. That could be a potential bluffing candidate. I'm spelling all of this out because it's obviously going to be the framework through which we build our large bet strategies and our overbet strategies. But it's also very important to understand how the middle works. So that more linear portion of our range. And what we mean by linear is starting with the strongest hand in our possession. If we're talking about preflop, it's aces, obviously. And we just start to populate downward through the equity layers. So you go from the strongest hands to the next tier of strength, to the middle tier of strength, to you know, your marginal hands, all the way down to your nothing. And this is exemplified in solvers through the hand classes. It'll show like what the absolute nuts are if a board is paired. It'll be quads, right? And then the next one will be full houses, and then flushes, straights. Basically, that card that comes with the deck of cards, we understand.
The hand rankings card.
Yeah.
The one that comes alongside the Joker.
Right. Yeah. Like, you didn't know it, but they were just putting strategy right in the deck for you whenever they first started printing these things. So it's important to understand how the full scope of a range looks, because one of the biggest errors I think that people fall into is that they reach too far into the linear portion of range. And they mistake a hand that is worth something, but not worth overbets for their bottom of their range. So, for instance, if we look at a board texture like King Jack 3 Deuce, we'll see people reach too far and they'll take a hand like Jack 10, perhaps, and they'll put it in their overbet range and they'll call that their bluff. Where it's like, no, your bluffs would be like 10-9 for a gut shot or 4-5 for an open ender.
Yeah. Or yeah. Honestly, even worse than that in a lot of spots. Like, there's,
correct.
There's a lot of spots where, specifically when you're overbetting turns, you want to make sure that you don't have hands that block the folding range. Mm-hmm. So if a big chunk of the folding range is stuff like 9-10, then you may not want to have 9-10 as an overbet there. You may want to have like
8-7.
Yeah, or it's going to pick some like absolute dust hands that have very, very little equity, but have the maximum unblocking power over the folds that you're going to get.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it becomes very critical to understand that just because we have a large bet strategy doesn't mean that we're restricted solely to that large bet strategy. If you recognize that on this particular texture, King Jack 3 Deuce, you want to bet a hand like King 10, and you see that it cannot fit into the overbet strategy because it's not strong enough, then understand you either need to have a second size or rethink the overbet strategy, right? We don't always have to, you know, simplify to the coolest option, so to speak.
What's the coolest option?
Overbetting is definitely the coolest option.
Okay.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, like I'm looking at a 200 big blind spot where King Jack 3 Deuce button big blind and turn strats just 300% pot.
Yeah, it's going to be 2E, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just have ace deuce, there's like no, turn two no, pair block.
No King 10 in there.
You have 7-6 for absolute nothing, right?
Oh, it does like 10-9. That's interesting.
10-9 because like you just don't get piled on and it's good blockers. They block like, because if you look at the...
Oh, right, because we block some folds, but we also block some top pairs.
You like, block value.
Yeah, right. We block. Yeah, that makes sense.
You need some coverage too. Like,
but like if you look at
you don't want a queen to roll off right. And never have a bet.
True, if you look at Jack 10, you'll just never bet it.
Right.
Your hand's too good.
Yeah.
Right.
I was thinking of, or I guess the...
And inversely, like ace 10 will never bet. So now it becomes crucial to have 10-9.
Mm-hmm. You have to cover yourself on a queen.
I guess right. The portion that I was thinking of that's doing it because of the unblocking properties is mostly that 7-6, 7-5, 8-5.
This is a single race pot, yeah, Landon?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The reason it likes queen deuce is because you're blocking the trips.
Yeah. You block two pair improves. You block Jack deuce suited, you block King deuce suited, and you don't interfere with the board, and you can also like make a good hand later.
Turning bottom pair is generally quite a good spot to overbet because when your opponent is check raising the flop with a lot of their flop two pairs, when you turn bottom pair, you're now blocking a lot of the hands that turn two pair, so you're blocking a lot of the strongest stuff on that particular turn. And
when they check raise, is this what you're saying?
Well, when they
don't check raise,
they're check raising.
We bet 3x pot.
Yeah. So like they're check, basically villain on the flop is going to check raise King Jack, Jack 3 and King 3 quite a lot. So when they check call and then the turn comes a deuce, King deuce, Jack deuce and 3 deuce suited, if they exist in range, are going to be some of the strongest hands in their range. But when you have Queen deuce suited or Ace deuce suited and you turn a deuce, not only do you not really win very often at showdown with a deuce anyway, but you have a lot of power to block the hands that just turn two pair. So you actually have a really good bluff candidate when you're using a really big size like that.
Yep. More likely you're going to get called by a single pair of king x's on the turn.
Like, I think it's also
king 10 on the turn versus 3x pot, like king 9.
Something that's kind of under-acknowledged about a lot of these overbet spots is the fact that even when you're doing it to target a relatively capped range, you have to be careful that you don't go too thin with it, right? Because we can see that the King 10 doesn't want to do it here, even though the overbet is getting called by a lot of like King 7, King 6, etc. And it's simply because when you're betting this size, the amount of worse hands that you're getting called by in comparison to better hands that you're getting called by, the ratio needs to change, right? You need to be even more confident that you're getting called by worse, and you want to be very, very rarely like value owning yourself, right? So the reason why King 10 doesn't overbet in this spot is partially because villain's range does still include enough King Queen that King 10 is now value owning itself against that. So the value range on this turn is actually mostly king queen plus.
Yep. When you look at like 6-4, you check because you bet ace 4. As when you have ace 4, you block their continues like ace jack.
Landon, real quick question: is there a way to filter to see which hands are overbetting that aren't value?
Yep. If you go, I can direct Landon to that if he's not there. But yeah, that's exactly where you go.
There's a filters, equity buckets, advanced 0 to 25.
I usually use the trash hands bucket for that. But it's the same thing.
So now you're showing hands that have very little equity, right?
This is trash hands, which is funny because I look at ace four and be like, oh, they're pretty sick.
Yeah. So that is that's the best way on Wizard, I think, to filter for what your bluffs are in any given spot. If you look at the overall strategy and then you filter for the weak hands, you can then see quite clearly which weak hands are choosing to bet and which weak hands are not.
Yeah. It's a cool shortcut because I've done this before and then I'm just kind of like looking for, okay, which ones are my absolute trash? And if there's a way to filter that, then yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and you can do it even more specifically if you actually click on the bet size. So if Landon clicks on where it says bet 24.7, you can just specifically highlight the ones that are actually betting and just get rid of all the others. So you can very quickly hone in on what the actual bluffs are.
Hey. Oh, wait.
You seem confused.
More so just like...
What are you searching for?
What am I trying to...
Okay, enough. I've had enough.
Well, I'm just like, I don't care.
That and solver stimming.
I don't care. We've gone way too far already. Like,
we've done too much.
We're getting down to the nitty gritty of like.
You gave a board texture. Fuck you.
No, it's fine to look at it. I think that's good. It's just, you know, we have to teach the overall concept. Or like, that's the question, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you generally arrive at overbets?
The very, very general version of it is overbet when your opponent's range is relatively capped, so they're not very often going to have better than one pair, and your range contains a lot of hands that are better than one pair. That is the really, really short and simple version of it. If you're up against a range where you don't have that much confidence that your opponent is narrowed to a lot of one pair, then you're not going to want to overbet. So when flush cards come in, when straight cards come in, and your opponent can have a lot of straights, two pairs, whatever, those types of spots are really bad for overbetting because a lot of the time you end up in a spot where it's very, very hard for you to value bet for a big size with anything other than the straight or the flush or the, you know, that specific category of hand. And there's often quite a lot of hands in your range that prefer betting a less big size. And as a result, you end up wanting to size down a little bit in those spots where some draws get there. But if you're up against a spot where your opponent's range is very one pair heavy, like that spot that we just saw, turn deuce in that spot just doesn't really improve very many hands at all. That becomes a great overbet spot because now all your strong hands really want to just pile money in and put pressure on all their one pair stuff.
Yeah, so one of the big reasons why I think it's important to map out how overbetting works is because so much of this is driven by like geometric sizing. So we talk a lot about geo sizing, we talk a lot about 2e3, that type of stuff. And the impetus behind betting geometrically is to get the money in by the river, right? It's so that the final bet is all in. And that will always be driven by polarized strategy, which tends to be a good roadmap for how to approach overbet spots anytime that the SPR is greater than 4. You know, when you have an SPR of 4, I think 2E is like 80%. Or sorry, it's pot. So like 4 and less, you're not really going to have a geometric size for overbets. But anytime that you start to get into the 5 through 10, which is going to be most single raise pots, you know, in a lot of these live games, you might even see SPRs of like... what did I say? SPRs. Yeah, you might see like stack to pot ratios of like 20 in single raise pots because you're playing 200-400 big blinds deep. So it becomes important to understand how overbetting works, and more importantly, like where we're deriving the sizing from. I think understanding and learning geometric sizing is really critical to this because now you have kind of a ceiling of like what you're looking for. It's rare that you're going to go bigger than geometric. Reason being is because then the following street is going to be scaling down in sizing.
Yeah, I can plug my course here. This is the course I made last year called Keep It Simple. I talked a lot about this where a lot of the decision-making protocols that I use are based around establishing at a certain SPR, certain spot, what's the geometric size for this spot. Once I figure approximately that out, that is the biggest size that I can consider using. And then from that, you can then build a sort of scale below that. So let's say geometric size is 1.3x pot. You can say, well, what sizes could I theoretically consider? I could consider 1.3x pot, 70% or like 40% maybe, right? Mm-hmm. And I'll just run through those in my head, like which of these sizes could be good in this spot? Because 40% is going to be pretty similar to 30 or 35. 70 is going to be similar to 60 or 80. So you really only need to consider each sizing region independently, with the geometric sizing being like the top end. And usually you're going to be able to arrive at a sizing somewhere within that that fits well for the strategy that you're building.
Right. So whenever we're now carving out our overbet sizings, like even when we start to want to think geometrically, the easiest way to look at it is, what do our best hands want to do, right? What do our nuts want to do? And understanding that oftentimes one pair will be considered the nuts. So most of the board textures we're going to be looking at for having geometric sizings, whether it's turn and river, flop turn and river, or flop and turn, they're going to be largely high card disconnect. So ace high, king high, queen high, with two low cards, queen three deuce, king three deuce, ace three, well, ace seven four, something like that, ace seven deuce, whatever. They're going to be paired boards, specifically low paired boards. So 7-deuce-deuce, 10-deuce-deuce, 10-3-3. Situations where our opponent isn't going to have many of the trips and our overpairs are just going to be worth infinite money, right? That's kind of like one of the easiest ways to carve it out is, what are the textures, what are the turns where my overpairs are just worth stacks? And oftentimes these low disconnected boards, high-low disconnected boards, high-low paired boards, these situations, we're not really concerned about being up against trips, so oftentimes we're just taking our best pair versus their one pair. Now, with that being said, we have to be able to recognize the difference between a brick and a non-brick on turn, right? So if we have a board texture like king three deuce, there's a big difference between a turn jack and a turn seven, right? Seven, stone brick. Jack, they're going to have a lot more of it. Like, they're going to be playing king jack off in their defense range. They're probably not going to be playing much king seven off. So that's a huge disparity in how often they improve. And that's not to say we can't overbet the jack. It's just more so that we have to be a lot more particular about how we approach the overbets on the jack than we are on the seven. And again, like, this might not even show up necessarily in a solver. It's just to get you thinking in terms of the difference in how equity moves, because that's truly the driving force behind the overbet strategy to begin with, is a large equity disparity. We're going to possess a significant equity advantage in situations where our bets are going to scale higher and higher and higher, right? So generally speaking, if our bets on the turn are going to be magnitudes larger than a bet on the flop, it's because a brick rolled off, which is going to further shift equity in our favor. This becomes important to understand because there's a fine line live, right? And I think that this is probably where a lot of the viewers will struggle, in that, say they have aces and the board comes, you know, the same one we've been discussing, king three deuce, and they bet quarter on flop because they're just range betting this board. Totally fine, right? They get called, turn is an offsuit seven, and they say, okay, I have overbets here. I have aces, I have ace king, I have king queen that can go for it, and then I have some clear bluffs like 4-5, 5-6, ace 5, ace 4, potentially utilizing like the deuce as a bluff, things of that nature, right? I'm going to bet 2e, and 2e in this situation is like 150% pot, and they go for it, and their opponent just folds king jack face up. This is really common live, right? And it's frustrating because you recognize that for certain people, their tolerance to call overbets is just non-existent. Like, if they're folding king jack, they have no calls, right? They just only have traps. Right. That's it. And they would have had to have started trapping on the flop, or they would have had to have turned pocket sevens or king seven, right?
Make you happy though, right? Because now your bluffs are getting through.
Well, that's the thing. So yes. So now we recognize that we get to have a massive imbalance to our overbet strategy against this particular player, but this player doesn't necessarily represent the pool. That's the tricky part, right? Because if you're playing in a public game 5 days a week in a place like Vegas that has high foot traffic, in a game like 2-5 where the turnover is quite high, it's difficult to know who's going to fold to the 150 and who's going to call the 150. So what ends up happening is people will simplify and they'll just bet 80% pot. Always there, right? And it's not a terrible simplification, but you become easy to play against because I never have to face the heat on that turn barrel, right? I just get to always play pretty well because the truth is versus overbet, King X isn't very indifferent, if at all. But like all of my underpairs are, a lot of my 7X, if not all of it, is indifferent, you know? I have to make some really tough decisions with like 4-5. And hands of this sort. So it becomes an issue because now I get to play a little bit more correctly, even if I'm unstudied versus the smaller size. And that's always going to be the case. The more you size down, the more quote unquote correctly your opponent will be able to play, even if they don't study. The caveat to that is, and the way people correct for it is they just don't bluff. And that's why the just pay has become such a meme for us, because there are certain price points where people just refuse to bluff. They bet half pot on the river. They just like refuse to bluff for this size.
Because they're not willing to bluff in a circumstance where they know they're giving their opponent the kind of price where they're not going to get a fold that often.
Right.
Like they're just, when they bet half pot, it's because they expect to get called. And when they bet 1.5X, it's because they expect to get a fold.
Right. So what they condition you to then do is start folding much more frequently than you're supposed to, according to theory, for the small size.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue with that is then you, as the defensive player, fall into this response of no hand is good enough to pay.
Right.
Right? So it's impossible to create an equity threshold that makes any logical fucking sense. Because too often it'll just go check, check when you have the best hand, mm-hmm. no matter how good your hand is. Right? And then the exception becomes like when you've trapped.
Right.
But the only reason that's an exception is because you passed on an earlier EV to not trap,
mm-hmm.
right? You passed on a turn check raise because you need to have some traps so that when you face half pot on the end, you can just win the pot some of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the resolution of that sort of loop is that the mistakes that people do make against these small bet sizes is they don't necessarily continue with the wrong ranges, but they definitely don't raise close to enough. So you end up in a situation where when you bet the river for half pot, in fact, the responding player is supposed to, they're supposed to bluff raise you at a pretty decent frequency, and they're actually supposed to probably raise for value fairly thinly against that size. But when they don't do that, now the player who bets half pot gets this comfortable scenario of if I get raised, I can just fold
right.
because I'm never getting bluffed.
Right.
And so it becomes an added bonus in their mind of additional information or additional opportunity to get away from the second best hand.
They win the maximum and lose the minimum.
Yeah. Like they're trying to do both things at once, right?
Right?
They're trying to get some value from their best when they have the best hand, but then, you know, never lose more money when they have the worst hand. And it almost becomes like if this game kept perpetuating this, it would just become limit hold'em where everybody just puts in the minimum amount of money. And then as soon as they start getting raised, they just end up folding.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just like that's not no limit anymore.
Right. You know? Right. And honestly, it's interesting you brought up limit poker because I think a lot of what those players take pride in is being able to fold, getting laid like 45-1 on the end.
Yeah, right.
And it's just like, I mean, why? Like, I know I would be a terrible limit player because there's just no scenario in the world where I have a hand that I think wins 10% of the time and I'm folding to fucking 145th pot.
I get the sense that a lot of the skill in limit hold'em is understanding the difference between a hand that wins like 5% of the time and a hand that wins 15% of the time.
Right.
Like just knowing which side of the line you're on when you have to bluff catch, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably true. And again, it's probably just a massively underbluffed environment overall.
Yeah.
Well, talking with Dan Zach about this, good at mixed games, he's like, the biggest mistake you can make as a no-limit player transitioning to mixed games is folding too much.
That's crazy. Imagine being a no-limit hold'em player who folds too much. I mean, I guess I could see it. Like,
what's about, like, you bet this small, like, because what happens is the environment conditions you to getting shown you have the worst hand. Like, you have bluff catcher lose,
right?
But your bluff catcher is like infinite to one, so it's like you just hope for the times that it's bluff catcher win.
Honestly, right. I think limit hold'em is like a great way to build up your callus to the negative feedback loop of poker. Right, you just go there and you just like pay a bunch of fucking money to lose. Like, literally, just I'm gonna go sit down for 6 hours and I'm gonna pay everybody at this table a whole shitload of money to kick me in the nuts.
Yeah,
and then, you know, by the time my 6 hours is up, I'm also gonna win my fair share and probably break dead goddamn even, but I'm gonna be better for it.
Here's the theory. My theory based on that is, I think if you could teach someone to become an expert limit hold'em player and an expert PLO player before they ever played a hand of no limit, they would instantly understand almost everything about no limit hold'em. Because I think limit hold'em has that aspect of like, you just have to pay because you're getting such a good price.
You learn the bluff catching region.
PLO, you start to understand board texture interactions, the way that different hands interact on different textures. You start
how
to
equity
have,
shift.
Exactly, like polar equity distributions within an individual four card hand and things like that. If you understand those two games, no limit is the middle ground between those two, and you can probably get really good at no limit just from understanding both no limit.
It's interesting.
Both limit and PLO.
It's interesting because I've played plenty of no limit with PLO players, and I've played plenty of no limit with limit players, and they're both shit.
Yeah, but like, that's probably because they're both completely contrasting groups of players.
For
right?
sure, because PLO players are conditioned never to bluff catch.
Yeah.
And limit players are conditioned
to never fold,
right?
So I bet if you could teach someone both those games to a high level before they ever played no limit, they'd probably get pretty good at no limit.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. It's interesting because I see the game of no limit, and granted, I guess I'm seeing it through colored glasses because I've come so far in my career. But to me now, it's all about sizing. Mm-hmm. It's the actual no limit aspect of it that makes the game so wonderfully complex to me.
Yeah.
And offers so much edge, I think, in scenarios, especially when stacks are deep. But you're right. Like, that's just an evolution of me having already conditioned myself through all these other basic principles that are needed in order to be a winning player, right? And now you start to get into the nuance and get to, you know, kind of add some finishing touches to what your playbook is. And sizing is just all of that. So yeah, doubling back to the overbetting strategy, I guess if I could give personally like one simple template, you know, we can't do a full lesson on this. We have plenty of stuff at Solver TV if you guys want to check that out, by the way.
And we have an academy. When is it? I mean, Brian Seek, so I got to do his plugs.
That's true.
We've got an academy May. I don't know the date.
May 23rd to the 25th is the Cash Game Academy. We'll be talking plenty of overbets there. And then May 27th to the 30th. It's 4 days.
Then.
Yeah,
sometime
it's a 4 day.
Then. Yeah,
that's the MTT Academy. We'll get you guys all prepped for the WSOP. If I can give you guys a simple template for how to approach overbetting, I would say that the beginner's guide to overbetting is find a range bet spot. So find a board that you know that you're betting your full range on, because in order to have a range bet, you already have a pretty large equity disparity in your favor, right? So we're talking like the ace king five type of boards. Now, granted, you could overbet the flop there, but let's not make it complicated. Let's just say you're range betting that board because that's a reasonable simplification. Find board textures like that that you're very comfortable range betting: ace deuce deuce, ace king five, king three three, king three deuce. Yeah, anything with seven deuce and a high card is a good example. So you're going to be range betting these spots, right? Once called, now what we want to try to focus on is compartmentalizing our range on turn between clear value, and understand that that doesn't mean like two pair plus. It just means like whatever you deem to be the bottom of your strongest one pair hand, right? So our clear value and then very obvious bluffs. And we're going to overbet those for 2E on turns. So if you're looking at a board texture, like, let's do a simple one, ace, deuce, deuce. Your clear value should end at whatever the best ace is that your opponent calls with pre. So let's say it's ace, jack. Our clear value then is going to be ace, jack plus. And then our clear bluffs are going to be cards that unblock our opponent's folding range. So basically, we want to position our opponent to having weak aces. So like ace seven or worse, ace eight or worse, middling pocket pairs, again, like pocket eights or worse, and then like backdoor hands, right? So we'll just curate our bluffing region out of hands like jack 10 that didn't have a backdoor. That's a pretty good example of one, right? We fold out a lot of the under pairs. We unblock a lot of the weakest aces that will fold by river. And then we also unblock the Broadway cards that had backdoors that now have to fold.
Yeah, the big hack there is when it's a rainbow flop and a Badoogie turn. So like ace, like let's say it's ace deuce deuce and it's like club diamond spade, and then the turn is the heart. A lot of your turn bluffs you want to have hearts.
Right.
You want to have hearts in your hand because you unblock all the backdoors that are just going to fold.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can even scale backwards where if you want to create a hierarchy of the suits in terms of which ones are the best ones to bluff with, if you look at other rainbow flops, what it'll be is that the best suit to bluff the turn with is the suit that matches the turn. The second best suit will be the one that matches the lowest card on the flop, and so on and so forth. So the worst suit to bluff with is the suit that matches the highest card on the flop. So if it's queen, six, deuce, you know, heart, diamond, spade, and then the turn is a seven of clubs, clubs are going to be best, spades are going to be second best, diamonds third best, and hearts are going to be the suit that you probably don't want to bluff the turn with. It's kind of a nice little hack that I've gotten from using Wizard.
Yeah, that makes sense.
A nice little takeaway I got from this was that you kind of innately learn how to defend. Like learning how to overbet or recognizing spots to overbet, I see it now where I find myself in the big blind and I see a range bet board. And I can tell myself, hey, I recognize that it's very possible my opponent is going to bet really big on the turn. And now I start defending hands that perhaps a year ago, 2 years ago, I would have been not so crazy about defending.
You mean on the turn or on the flop?
On the turn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it also should influence your flop strategy. If you recognize that an overbet's going to come through a lot, you should take those cusp hands that are between calling and raising that will perform better through the raise line and start raising them, right? So if you have a gut shot and you recognize that it check raises some of the time, but if you check call, you're just going to get doubled on and have to fold, particularly one with like a backdoor. Like what you don't want to have is, let's use this queen 6-3 board that Hunt just chose, right?
Queen 6-3 Badoogie, right?
Queen 6-3 Badoogie. Mm-hmm. You defend a hand like 7-5 with backdoor spades, right?
Okay.
And then the turn is the 10 of spades and you came through the check call line and now you face 2x pot. You're in hell.
Yeah.
You're just in hell because now you have
really
to fold.
Want to peel here.
Right,
so we have a flush draw and a gut shot now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And you have to fold.
Right.
Right? But yeah. If you check raise that hand on the flop,
it's pure.
And then you get the 10 of spades.
This is a great example of
It's not A, it's not a range bet, whatever. B, you check raise the backdoor suits because you don't want to get doubled.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So the
polar size, you go like 120%.
There was a hand that I think someone posted in our group chat earlier, the Triton hand with Henrik Hecklin and not the big bubble hand that they played.
Okay. Yeah.
Eight, nine of diamonds.
The 8-9 of diamonds that Henrik had where he played check, call. I thought his hand was a much more clear check raise on the flop, not just because he has a combo draw, but because specifically when you have this hand, you can turn a lot of draws that make you not want to fold the turn. But in the spot that he had, where he actually turns, I think, an open ender as well as his flush draw, he faces a big turn bet. He faces like a pot sized turn bet, but he knows he can't really have any very many check jams against that size. So he ends up check calling and then finding a way to do like a weird river lead for like 10% pot or something and actually get a fold.
Yeah.
But
I'd be shocked if that was like, that was a freestyle for sure.
I think it's a little bit, yeah, it's probably unlikely that the solver does any donking on this river. But yeah, I think this hand is a good example of like, when you have this much equity, if it's a board texture where there's going to be some big bets on turn that come in, it really puts you in a tough spot to be turning more equity and then forced to check call with like 9 high. So
check raising here on the turn, is that what you're saying?
I'm saying check raise the flop, really. Obviously Henrik's a great player and it's very possible he's just mixing calls and raises on the flop here with this combo, but I think that these combos tend to play better on flop because there's so many spots where you you turn even more equity and you face a big bet, you don't really want to check call with nine high, you know. And he does find a strange river lead, which it really felt like to me was just designed to get Panat to fold his bluffs, you know, to get him to fold king high, exactly king like what six. He had, right? Yeah. Stuff like that, you know. So
queen 10.
It's an interesting line, but I think that this hand just wants to raise flop, and if it doesn't raise flop, then maybe we just check jam turn and live with the results.
Yeah, I could see that being the case on turn, because you just don't want the exact scenario that happened. Yeah. You also want to free up the 10, right? Like, king-queen just has to mm-hmm. fold to a jam.
Yeah.
So it's nice to give yourself true outs. So yeah, I mean, whenever you're building out the template for overbetting, I think that it becomes critical to understand. You want to keep a few things in mind. You want to keep in mind the equity distribution and who holds the advantage there. You want to keep in mind the nut advantage. And then you want to keep in mind turn and river cards that could potentially change how that equity is being distributed, right? So paired boards, rainbow boards, Badoogie turns, these all make for very clean and easy overbets. But the truth is that the overbet actually is going to come slightly higher frequency. Maybe that's not true, but when the turn flush draw comes through, we're often going to be incentivized to have more overbets as well, because now your opponent's going to gain equity similar to like the hand we just watched, where they turn more equity and you want to put that particular region of their hands in the cage.
So, but just for clarity, you're specifically saying when it's a rainbow flop,
rainbow flop turn backdoor
arrives at backdoor. Yeah. Yeah, we're not saying a flush completing turn.
Correct. Sorry,
just for the sake of the audience. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's very important to I guess complementing this conversation is doubling back on what Matt said earlier. You have to know where your upper bound size comes from. And in most situations, there are obviously always going to be exceptions, but in almost all situations, most situations, when a flush completing turn comes, when a flush completing turn comes, when a straight completing turn comes, generally your sizing strategy is going to be capped at around pot.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to be pretty rare that we exceed into the overbet range there. We're not going to geo size very often unless SBR is low.
Two main reasons for that being that, number one, when the flush completes on the turn, your opponent can almost always have a decent chunk of flushes, which means that it's very, very difficult for you to value bet anything that's not a flush if you start trying to overbet.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is when you actually have a flush, because you block your opponent from also having a flush in most cases, what you end up with is if you start overbetting with your flushes, you actually don't get a lot of value because they start to get to a point where a lot of their one pair and hands like that just end up having easy folds versus a big size on a flush card. So your flushes actually don't want to overbet because it's harder to get value. And then the rest of your range doesn't want to overbet either because they just run into a flush.
Right. And I think this is a mistake that people often make. We did it in the muck earlier this week where Andy folded a flush on the turn to 4x pot jam. And it just becomes an issue of like, well, you have to see it from the complementary side of things. It's like, could he 4x pot jam the nuts? Maybe. I mean, it's not out of the realm of being conceivable. Is he going to 4x pot jam the naked nut flush draw? I guess, but like, he doesn't have to. You know, it becomes one of those things where like you just start playing a risk reward type of mentality and understand that it's way easier to do things that come with egregious sizings with the nuts than it is with air.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the last thing that I'll say about overbetting before we move on is be careful. If people are overbetting flush boards, they're more likely to have it than not, mm-hmm. right? It's just, there was a point where people didn't understand theory very well 5 years ago when solvers were first becoming like a lot more popular and bleeding into the general populace, where the flush completing turn would come and they would have the nut blocker and they would just like rocket it off.
Yeah.
But it was so obvious. Mm-hmm. It was so transparent because like you would yourself just be holding a flush
mm-hmm.
and face like pot and a half. And it's like, oh, this dipshit has ace jack off with the ace of spades and is just going ape here.
Mm-hmm.
Like GG, my guy, you know, it's over for you. Or same thing on like monotone flops. Like they just start by betting pot. and you have a flop flush.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh man, I'm so sorry for you.
This is going to be easy.
Yeah. It's like when it's not intuitive, it's very clear that you have to recognize that either they're going to shift to one end or the other. Right. And it's very easy to do non-intuitive things with the nuts. Mm-hmm. So blasting out large sizes, oftentimes is going to be exactly what you believe it to be. Stone mm-hmm. nuts. Second thing is, this will apply even on streets that do have, or textures that do have overbets, if you're against opponents that don't know what the fuck they're doing, right? If you find somebody overbetting on ace, king, five, deuce, you should be pretty concerned that they have two pair plus.
Mm-hmm.
Unless like you think that they're relatively studied and good, in which case, yeah, now they have jack 10. Now they have, you know, 5-4 and 6-4.
8-9 and weird shit, yeah, like that. They have all those unblockers.
Exactly. They have hands that are supposed to do this with, and now you can defend a lot more liberally. But, you know, you have to kind of... I'm trying to give you shortcuts because you're not going to learn this all overnight. So you can start to look for certain things in your environment and adjust. Now, with all that being said, this is not good enough to understand how to play overbets or how to defend against overbets. You have to do the work. You just absolutely, at some point in time, you need to get in there and do the work and see what types of hands become pure calls versus a double barrel overbet on ace, king, five, deuce, and what hands become indifferent, because you're going to be surprised, right? Like, I think you're going to be shocked to see that there are going to be scenarios where it might be happier to call with a hand like ace six than ace jack, or maybe ace 10 being a better example. Point being is that it's very sensitive to the region through which your opponent's pulling his bluffs from,
mm-hmm.
right?
Specifically because they have like straight draws and stuff.
Yeah, there. Yeah. Yeah. If you need them to have jack 10, then like it doesn't benefit you. Your kicker doesn't matter much, right? Because like they either have ace queen or better, or they don't. In which case, like, what the fuck's the difference? Ace jack, ace three, who cares? I'm either pipped or I'm not, you know, that kind of thing. And you have to have some hands to defend. Moreover, like, when you improve, you don't want to improve dirty. You don't want to have a hand like ace 10, have a 10 rip off on the river, and they just have queen jack. That's never a fun experience either.
Yeah.
So this is, what's that?
So this is a good talk. I like this. Yeah. I'm learning today.
This is one of those scenarios, like this can go all the way back to the Jonathan Little tweet of like, if you're unsure, just fold because you're probably not giving that much up. Don't.
You mean the Jonathan Little marketing tweet?
Yes. I'm strongly encouraging you not to take that easy way out because it only leads to a massive amount of EV loss. Simply put, like, why... Billy's coming to us to begin with. He's in enough pain, facing enough overbetting, where he's folding hands that he knows are too good that he wants to know what the fuck is going on, right? And just paying isn't working either, because when people overbet, they're going to have it at least half of the time. That's how bluffing to value ratio works, you know? You're not going to find spots where people have more bluffs than they do value bets.
Right.
It's just not the way that the math works out. I mean, you might be lucky to find spots where they have more bluffs than value bets, but now you just identified the strongest player in the pool who's massively over bluffing every single spot, and you have to strap in and call him down every fucking time you have top pair. That's just the way, yeah, that's the way it works, you know?
Here's a question to wrap up this discussion. What's the biggest over bet you've ever made?
10x pot.
10x pot.
Yeah.
Tell us the hand.
He had the nuts.
No, I did not. I had 5 high. I defended big blind versus Kier. I could be getting the details wrong. It might not have been 10x pot, but in my head, it was 10x pot.
It's cooler that way.
No, I'm just, I feel pretty strongly about it, but maybe not.
Because it was at least like 7 or 8x pot.
It was a big, I jammed river for 20K and it was a single raise pot at 1-1. So the way the hand played out, I had 5-4 clubs and the board came like, I want to say it was like jack 2-3, two clubs. Mm-hmm. I check raised. He 3-bet. I called. Did he 3-bet? I'm trying to think because I had the betting lead the whole way.
It would be hard for him to 3-bet if the SPR was still high on the river.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe he didn't 3-bet. Maybe he just called. I just remember like really funky things happening in his hand. Anyway, the way it played out is I end up tripling this hand. Oh, I had backdoor. That's right. It was rainbow board. And it came backdoor club on the turn and then brick on the river. So it was like jack 3 deuce. I check raise. Something happened. We get to the turn. Turn's a club. I overbet. He calls. And I didn't go geo. River was, I think, a 7. So I think the final board texture was like jack 3 deuce 9-7. No. Mm-hmm. No, because he had 9-8. Jack 3 deuce 10-7 or something like that. No, that would have given him a straight. Whatever. Anyway, neither of us had a pair on the end. Oh, that's exactly what it was. Turn was a 7, river was an 8, and I jammed the river and he called me with 9-8.
Wow.
Where he had just like,
oh yeah, this one
peeled the back door, turned the higher clubs, and then rivered a pair. Wow, and swore to God that he was going to call me with 9-high. Like, he was just emphatic that he was going to call me with 9-high. I'm like, okay.
I don't believe you.
I don't believe you, but I kind of believe you. I wish I had ace 5 instead. I guess
that would have been hilarious.
But yeah, the whole hand itself was very strange.
I don't know if I've ever made a massive overbet like that. Playing tournaments, you don't get to the river with massive SPRs high like often enough, you know. So you're stuck just 3x potting like a pleb, you know.
Yeah. I also played a really big one versus jungle. I think it might have been off stream at the bike where, or not jungle, sorry, it was against Limitless. I think it was off stream, but I opened 7s from the cutoff and he defended the big and it came king 7-4. And I just went, I didn't know geo because we were way too fucking deep. I think we were 120K effective. And the pot, single raise pot, I think we were playing 1-2. So there might have been like 1,000 in the middle.
Jeez.
So we were like 100-ish. Yeah, like 100-ish SPR. And I think I went pot, 3 pots, all in.
Wow.
Just knowing that like he's going to try to find proper defenses against this sizing scheme, even though it like may not exist. So that actually might have been my biggest river shove. It was certainly over 4 pots.
Did he pay?
Yeah. I think he had like king jack, king queen, something like that.
Wow.
But it's just like once he calls pot on the flop on a, you know, texture like this, it's either 5-6 or top pair type of hand most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, like, you know, you just stand to get paid. It's very lucky to have a set in those spots.
Wild.
Landon,
do you have any history of massive overbets? Have you ever made the old 8x pot, the old 10x pot?
Pads does it all the time.
I don't know if I've played like deep enough. Well, I guess in tournaments sometimes, and like single raise pot, check lines on your own river where you're big, defend big blind, and like you can river trips and they can't.
Yeah.
And just can like send in 6x pot.
I call it a 5x pot. That was a mistake. Fucking airball.
Yeah, that's this? That's something when doing again.
When he had queen jack versus
oh,
my set.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was bad.
I wonder if Connie's doing any overbetting in the series.
Well, you know, we have a very special in the muck today, guys. Your man Conrad coming to us from the middle of nowhere, middle America. He's got a hand history that we don't even know if it's accurate, but we're going to listen to it anyway.
What is popping, everybody? It's time. We're in the muck. We got fucked up good. All right, so listen to this hand history. I'm going to tell you guys this little story as I walk the streets of Michigan, and you guys tell me what you think, all right? So we're chip leading. We have, I want to say we have like 45 big blinds with like 3 or 4 off the money. We open cutoff with king 8 of clubs. The button calls. He's calling off about like 30 big blinds. So I assume he's like third in chips or something like that. Button calls. Flop is queen jack deuce with 1 club. We decide to go for 40%. get called. Turn is a deuce. So we're not stopping here. We found the deuce. Hold on, deuce. Hold on to your fucking seat, old man. So we bet again. But I want to say we bet like close to pot. We get called. Alright. River comes to 7. And we have 125% pot left. I see no reason not to just be all in. You know, sometimes at this point you can just, you know, mention that we're 3 out of the money. It's never a bad idea. I did it. Because it might be collusion or something like that. But, you know, you can always mention it if you want. But, yeah, so I went all in for 125% pot here. And this gentleman decided to... puff, puff, and blow my fucking house down. Because the man called with 6s. Now, if you don't hear me right, I said 6s. That's the one with the 3 marks on one side, and then another 3 marks on the other side of the card. Yes, the man called me with 4th pair, equaling 6s. I'm in the muck.
He didn't listen.
I didn't hear you, sorry.
Literally said go to me.
Sorry.
You're going to you, Landon. Like, what are you going to me for?
All right, so Conrad... Conrad's doing some shit.
When is he not? He's always doing some shit.
You know, he's not, though. He's a fucking nit, man. He's a fake action pro.
He's fake action Conrad. We're always saying that.
The only people tricky. Now, this hand,
in spots he
stop killing
be.
His action, man.
This hand to me is some special sort of torch.
Special.
I think that, you know, obviously people are going to be way too wide, and you do have the chip lead, and, you know, he did mention that it's the bubble. But I think that you have to be careful in these... mid-America tours where people who don't really understand ICM other than the fact that it exists and that they're supposed to play tighter at certain points of the tournament are going to look at a young person who is blasting off and say, well, you either got it or you don't, and you're pretty incentivized to not have it here. So fuck you, I call. And I think a little bit of that was going on here, but also I don't think this is a good hand to be choosing, right? Like the queen jack high boards, I feel like versus a button defense, they're going to hit him pretty squarely. And I mean, are we trying to get him to fold a jack here by the end? That seems tricky.
I would assume we are, because that's the only thing that makes sense. Like to get him to fold like jack 10.
Right. Like, I guess I wonder from Conrad's perspective, if he thinks that like a queen is hitting the muck here ever. Because like I would just not start with that presumption. And I would think it would be difficult to get somebody to fold a jack, because any jack that he possesses on this texture is going to be a pretty reasonable one. You know, you're going to mostly have like jack 10 suited, which would be the one that falls off, I guess, but only because it blocks bluffs. You're going to have ace jack, king jack, which are going to do way more blocking of value than bluffs versus Conrad's range. I mean, I think ace jack is probably almost a better bluff catcher than queen 10.
Yeah, I think the way I see this spot is it's really going to heavily depend on villains, what villain's doing pre-flop. Because theoretically, when we're approaching the bubble, they're supposed to be quite tight pre against the chip leader.
Right.
We're supposed to fold some pocket pairs. We're supposed to not speculate that much. The wider they get, the more it becomes completely reasonable to probably just range bet this flop when you're the chip leader, because they start to have a bunch of hands that they shouldn't even have in the first place.
Mm.
Then, as their range narrows through the streets, it starts to get harder and harder to see what we're actually targeting at each point.
Right.
Now, if Conrad thinks that villain is not actually even going to... I mean, villain called down with sixes, but let's say Conrad thinks on the turn... villain's probably not folding sixes, and I'm just targeting like their ace highs that called the flop. Now, if villain still possesses all those pocket pairs, then barreling the river becomes a bit more reasonable, because they have a lot left for us to target. But as soon as they start to, if we actually think they're folding those pocket pairs on the turn, now we're the only way we can barrel that river is if we think they're going to fold like a jack, like you say, or even a queen sometimes. And it gets a lot more dicey. So I think it comes down to preflop and how wide they are. And then in turn, that's going to affect as you get through the streets, like where they might be overfolding or where they might have, you know, a bit more of a narrowing of the range. And I think if we knew they were calling the turn pretty wide, this might be okay. But if we think that they are calling the turn appropriately, it seems hard for us to get away with tripling off here.
Yeah, I agree with that analysis. I also think that it's unfortunate because it's like when the bottom pair pairs, obviously Conrad has to like go. But then you run into the situation of like, okay, well, bottom pair paired, we sized up, got called, and you know, what the fuck does he have? Right? We block King 10. We unblock 10-9, I guess, and that's going to have to call twice, but we beat 10-9. Mm-hmm. So we don't really even need to bluff against that particular hand. Like, what are we trying to get to fold here by the end, other than just like beating ourselves over the head with a hammer saying like, well, this is what happens on the bubble. Like, we just play all in pots. Mm-hmm. I would have rather have seen him just jam the turn if we're going to go this route. You know, it's extreme, obviously, but you actually put the guy to a decision with a jack, and now you put jack X in a really tough spot, and your bluffs will function pretty well this way as well. I don't know exactly what the SPR was, and I don't think Conrad does either, but when we take a look at this in theory, I imagine it's not going to do any of the things I'm suggesting. It's just I theoretically think that the hand is just like a pure give up basically on every node. But once you find yourself on the turn when bottom pair pairs, it becomes very difficult to be a give up because it's one of many hands we have that are worth nothing to us, and it is the bubble. So it's like, if ever I'm going to pressure a jack, it's when bottom pair pairs and all my over pairs are just going to be able to go nuts.
I also think the thing you have to kind of keep in mind here as well is, I can't remember, did he say what buy-in this event was?
He did not, but I think it was the main event, so I'm guessing like 1100 or 1600.
Okay, so not so much in these events, but I was thinking like a lot of these smaller events, $400-$500 buy-ins, there's a very real factor of a lot of people just not caring about the bubble. Mm-hmm. Like when the bubble is not a substantial amount of money, quite often people just don't give a shit about it. Like they really aren't paying that much attention to it.
Right.
Especially if it's a larger field where the bubble sort of phase of the event is going to go past pretty quickly.
Yeah. You really got to have a feel for how invested does he feel having gotten to this point?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've had my own experiences with torching it on the bubble and, you know, not recognizing that someone just actually doesn't care about the bubble.
Right.
Like I did that in the main event 3 years ago. And, it can very much be the case that if this particular opponent is very focused on the bubble, this play could actually be doing pretty well. But equally, if this person just doesn't really care about the bubble, this play could be absolutely torching.
I actually don't think there's any way that this play could ever do well, because if you have somebody who's sensitive to the money bubble, mm-hmm. Once he calls the turn, we're dead. We're stone dead. We're drawing absolutely fundamentally dead.
You don't feel like there are some players that'll call a queen on the turn and then just be like hoping we check the river, and then when we jam the river, they just fold everything?
Yeah. Yeah, they exist, I think.
I think it's been too long since you played a 1K.
Well, no, they exist, but it's like what queen, like that through that character or that archetype, mm-hmm. what queen got there, right? It's like ace, queen, and king, queen suited.
Yeah, I literally think that there are some players that will fold almost their entire range in this spot. But yeah. That's a small portion of the player pool, right? Like
right.
It's just as small as the portion of the player pool that's considering just like heroing you with ace.
They're
10,
also
ace
folding 10 almost their entire range on the turn,
it gets so narrow at each point.
Like, that's kind of what I'm saying, is like mm-hmm. they're already almost folding their entire range on the turn. Mm-hmm. So it becomes tricky to try to double down on that and say like, okay, whatever little sliver you have left, let's make sure you muck it here.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of that player profile as like, they call some pairs pre, they fold their pairs on the flop, they fold a jack on the turn, and then they fold a queen on the river.
You know? I think that's reasonable.
Like that does exist in some player profiles. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the other profile that like, they basically never fold the flop, and then they call every pair or draw on the turn, and then maybe on the river they're only folding everything worse than a jack.
Right, and that's the important takeaway here before we actually get to what happens in theory, is that you have to look at the extreme the extreme character we had to draw up to make this okay. Mm-hmm. We have to find somebody who folds the middle of the range on the flop, the middle of the range on the turn, and then the top of the range on the river, right? Like that has to be the template to where we can now bluff everything. So we had to create a scenario where by river they will pure fold range, and by river we can pure bluff our range, or we can fire off three with the entirety of our range. That, even though it may exist, it's going to be relatively rare, especially when we're in a positional disadvantage. I think it would be different if it was like a big blind defense, right?
Yeah.
So by that metric alone, I think Conrad's like lighting a good stack on fire in a situation that it's just more profitable to surrender.
There's also another thing about these spots where you have to be mindful that when you're the chip leader, every additional chip has less value to you, mm-hmm. right? The marginal value of chips means that you have a lot of incentive as a chip leader to invest in pots, to keep opening, keep playing small pots, taking down small pots where you can. But as soon as you get into a big pot as the chip leader, you have to be very mindful that the amount of chips you're contesting in that pot is worth less to you than it is to the other player. Because if checking down and giving up allows you to still retain the chip lead, that might be more valuable than the small amount of chips you might gain by bluffing in a certain spot.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. All right, Landon, walk us through the theory of this.
Sure. So this is a spot that I found in the Wizard database where cutoff, it's on near bubble, so like two off the money or something along those lines, where cutoff covers, has 44 bigs, button is 30, then Conrad City is 35, but like this is the closest we're going to get. Small blind is 15, and then big blind has less than the button. And we see here that we're raising like more than half the time pre-flop, mostly blocker expansive, like ace x off is really good because you block getting three bet. King x off, same idea, and then suited cards are good because you can flop some form of equity and maybe check back and things along those lines. Where if you look at like a 35 big blind effective chippy v spot, you're raising 36% of the time pre. So with more pressure, you can raise more when you cover everyone behind.
We're basically opening a button range from the cutoff.
So we open, and the button is supposed to find some jams with like the hands that don't really want to call because they're really good at making it so the cutoff opens and then folds to the jam versus playing the pot themselves. But
that's definitely one thing that's not happening in 1K. Like
this call range is going to be like pure call.
Yeah, everything that's jamming some frequency there call is probably playing pure call with maybe some three bets in practice.
And then ace-king is probably jamming.
Yeah, exactly. Ace-king probably just pure jams.
But yeah, so this is kind of like an issue-ish when it comes to like the theory of it all. But the button calls and they fold. They go to post-flop. Great solution. It's fine. Doesn't have to be perfect.
Queen jack three, right?
Oh, I thought it was Queen Jack Deuce.
Either way, it was Queen Jack Deuce. Because the turn Deuce paired, and then Conrad was really happy about it.
Understandably so.
So we love that bottom here, pair. So in this spot, it looks like it's not with ICM, it's just like the range versus range.
Oh, shit.
Hunt's having a problem. Hunt's dimming. No, you're fine.
Knocked over my water.
Looks like, I mean, it's weird because ranges are different, but it looks like the button does have some of the pairs, like these pairs a little bit, and not that much connectivity with the queen and the jack, just because they jam pre a lot or do something like three bet. End of the day, doesn't matter too much. Like it's the Broadway cards that are suited are pretty happy with this, but they do have some hands that can be relatively annoyed versus like a 40% pot. But there is no solution for this spot that never takes place. What? Never did. Yeah. Why is it never taking place?
Just
when it's right there.
Just rerun it. Just refresh it.
Click the button.
It's like, it does that sometimes.
It's like 26% of the time before.
Oh, that's very weird.
It's changed.
Connie broke the machine.
Yeah, Connie broke the sim.
This is what happens. He finally submits an in the muck, and now Wizard is in the muck.
Rerun it from the start. That's usually.
What?
Man.
But yeah, I think there's...
You know, reject me,
there
daddy.
There you go.
The version that we're going to get when we run this with the...
Okay, so Conrad had a backdoor suit, I think, right? Maybe. I think he had clubs. So you can bet like 40%, it goes bigger actually, it goes 67%, but Conrad goes weird sizes. Looks like you can bet this one just because you have some blockers to king queen and you have some unblockers to the middly pair. Like you'll see here, like seven, sixes, fives mm-hmm. all get mad. Ace highs get really mad too, so you clean up your flush draw. And then you block a lot of their continues, like king, queen, king, jack, king, 10, king, 9. So the king is actually a really nice card here when you have it back to a flush draw. But so Conrad goes like, this for the sizes of the machine, because he said he somehow jammed pot for 120%.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've gone smaller on the flop, which is fine, and you can still do it in relation to whatever the machine has decided on this. Turn was brick deuce, right? Like,
Basically, Geo is like...
Brick deuce turn, you give up. You're scared because he called you. Like, your EV of the flop bet was hoping that they folded the flop, and they didn't do that. Mm. And now we have no equity, and we have the king X block, which is still nice. But at the same time, if you do end up getting called in the spot, and the size that we'd want to use is like a bigger one, like a queen X plus size, we're not really betting a jack. The only jack we are betting is queen jack, which is two pair. So now we have big size. Ace jack. Yeah, ace jack.
They bet jack four suited too. Jack three.
True. It's because they chop with the other jack X's and buttons range, right? Like jack 10 still chops. Like jack 10, because it's twos and jacks with the queen. Point being, like, the lower kickers are now better than the medium ones because the lower ones don't interfere and you still chop with jack 10 anyways, whether you have jack 6 or jack 3. So anyways, you're supposed to go a bit bigger. King 8 doesn't want to bet because it has bad properties, which is interesting because like king 6 is betting. But it's because when you B77, you get 8s to fold. Or like some of the time. Who knows what's really going on here with like why king 8 wants to bet and king 6.
Look at the card removal values. So something like king 8, you go to king 8, it's got a king 8 of hearts, for example, has a 2 for value removal and a 3 for trash removal.
Right.
Compare that to king 6. King 6 has a 2 and a 1. So king 6 has less trash removal, basically. King 8 is blocking more of the trashier hands in
Vogue's range. Like ace 8 suited?
Exactly. We're blocking a little bit too much of the bottom of their range. So even though it's not necessarily about 8s, just simply the fact that we're blocking their ace 8 suiteds is enough to change to the point where we don't bet king 8, but we do bet king 6.
Right. That's pretty good. That makes sense.
Trash removal is a really good thing to look at on Wizard to see why it's barreling certain combos ahead of others, because quite often it'll come down to, you know, a certain hand's properties in terms of equity aren't very obvious, but the trash removal is going to make the difference between a barrel and a not barrel.
Right, like we're using these high-low combos like the ace-3.
Yeah, the stuff that has like a 1 for trash removal is pretty good.
Yeah, these are all 1s.
Right, what about ace-3? Ace-3 of hearts is like a 5. I guess that's because it blocks the ace-high backdoors.
Which makes it bad.
Yeah.
But it blocks too much value.
Yeah, it's blocking only a little bit of value, so.
Yeah, it's blocking some ace jack. It gets the higher ace highs to fold, so you clean up your out.
Right.
Interesting.
Just having an ace is probably nice as well in comparison to having a king.
Interesting. So whatever, bet call. Like that's cool.
7 river, wasn't it?
Yeah. But the issue here is like 77% pot is 2E. He said he went whatever. Mm-hmm. But point being, like king 6, you can rifle off. Like king 8 doesn't really exist, and it doesn't really do well for the trash removal, because if ace 8 folded the turn, now they have too strong of a range on the river, so you don't want to bluff with it. So when Conrad jams, and the guy has 6s.
Wow.
Let him
cook.
Let the guy cook.
Let him cook. Connie, he cooked your face.
Fuck you, Conrad.
Absolutely cooked the face.
Wow. I mean, to be fair, it was only like one of the combos that gets in there a lot, but. If he had 6 of spades, 6 of diamonds, Conrad, he GTO'd you. You got GTO'd.
He just got face melted.
Yeah, you got face melted. Okay, that's a great takeaway, I think, because theoretically, the guy played his hand fine. And, you know, if you get called down with 6s in this spot in a live bird, you probably torched.
Well, the caveat there is that because we don't know the exact stack depth.
Right.
What Connie said is he went 40 pot 120.
Right.
Which would mean he would have to be deeper pre-flop.
Yeah, there were like 85 blinds
but
effective.
It's
a billion blinds.
And if that is the case, then on the one hand, you've got the ICM aspect of them being deeper. But on the other hand, you've also got the fact that the river bet being 1.2x pot instead of 77%.
Yeah.
Probably would make sixes fold. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So now, like, the ambiguity of the information we have changes.
Well, also
a
more
bit.
Importantly, if a man shows you sixes in this line, in a Midwest tour 500 down bad event, you fucked up.
Yeah.
Show him a jack. Mm-hmm. Show him a queen.
Yeah. And like,
show him a rivered seven that you turned into a bluff.
That'd be sick, actually. Kind of just bluffs off 7-8.
Yeah. It'd be dope. If you guys would like to submit your own version of In the Muck, be sure to head over to our Discord channel, hashtag Discord in the chat, or you can find it at the only, at the Solve4Y Twitter. It's our pinned comment. That's at Solve4Y TV. Also, be sure to head over to at Only Friends Pod. Give us a follow there as well. We're going to wrap today with a quick rundown of Twitter Tuesday that we missed yesterday. We asked, what conspiracy theory do you secretly believe in?
Oh, the replies on this were out of hand.
So much traction.
They're out wild. Of hand. Caitlin Comiskey said the Illuminati. Bert McGirt said the power of white magic and put a nice little meme up there. That one was good. Casino King said standing up before the river increases your odds of winning by 10%. I believe in that one, actually.
Shout out to Joe Volpe who said birds aren't real. That's a fun one.
Not going to repeat DePaulo's. I'm avoiding getting canceled in 2024. Thank you, DePaulo, for your submission. And then mine, which was obviously a fucking meme that somehow the internet doesn't get jokes. I quote tweeted it and I said, she misread her hand.
And she replied to you,
She replied with prayer hands.
Oh my gosh.
It's too good, man. The internet is too fucking good. I love every bit of it. Thank you guys so much for joining us today. We'll be back again tomorrow, 12 p.m. Pacific. As always, we'll have Poodog Melissa in the building. We'll see you guys all then.
Peace.
Peace.